And as we begin this new series, which will be over the coming 3 weeks leading up to Easter, we're going to be looking specifically at the book of John, chapter 18, which is one of the accounts of Jesus' life, the last few hours that led up to his death. And as we go through chapter 18 of the book of John, we're going to be looking specifically at some of the people and the relationships that Jesus encountered in these final few hours of his life, the impact that that made on him, but also that can have on each of us now. And today we're going to be looking at the whole character of Judas. So Jesus's disciple, his friend who betrayed him, the traitor who handed Jesus over to be arrested in the garden, as we have just read. Now, over the last period of time, we've seen this kind of whole area of betrayal quite a lot in the news. Betrayal of trust from church leaders to the people that they are leading. Betrayal of trust from politicians, from world leaders. And often, if you're like me, even if it doesn't directly affect you, you still feel the effects of it. You still feel that sense of anger, of unrighteousness, of injustice, of what has happened, because someone who we put in a position of trust has let us down. Now, I don't know how many of you watched the BBC series Traitors. I am going to give a few little spoilers, so if you haven't seen it and you're joining us at home, maybe go make a cup of tea for a few minutes, or if you're in the room, it's fine to go to the toilet. Please feel free to leave if you don't want to hear. It will only be a few minutes. But Traitors is essentially a kind of TV show, a game show, essentially, where a group of people are chosen who apply just from members of the public. They get put into this big old castle for a couple of weeks, and they have to spend those couple of weeks doing challenges, games, to try and win money, which goes into a big prize fund, which people who are left at the end of the game will win. Right at the beginning of the game, some of the people who are put into this castle are given the role of traitors. It's a little bit like a really big game of Wink Murder, if you remember playing that when you were little. So they get given the role of traitors. Their job as traitors is to try and get rid of everybody else in the castle so that they're the last one standing. Because if a traitor is left at the end of the game, they get to take the whole prize fund home. The rest of the contestants are given the role of faithfuls. So their job, because there is more of them, is to try and work out who are the traitors and try and banish the traitors, so at the end of the game, it is just the faithfuls left and they split the prize money and take it home. It became a really popular series. Series 1, the finale on BBC, drew in 3.1 million people. Series 2, the finale, drew in 6.9 million people and was the most watched TV programme of the BBC in the whole of January this year. But the endings, the finales, were very, very different. So season 1 got to the finale. There were 4 people left in the finale. 3 of them were faithfuls. 1 of them was a traitor. And just as Claudia Winkleman, who I adore, not everyone feels that way, but I would like to think she'd be my best friend if I knew her. Claudia Winkleman's there and she said, right, does anyone want to vote again? And 2 of the faithfuls said, yes, we want to vote again because we think there is still a traitor in our midst. They voted and they got the right guy. The traitor was banished, so the faithfuls won the money and they split it between them. They each won £33,000. Even the end, there was a sense of celebration. Because even in that moment where the faithfuls said, we think you're the traitor, and the guy said, okay, hands up, I've been a traitor all along. You saw this relief go off him and he said, I'm so glad now I can be honest with you because you've become my friends. And even though some of the faithfuls had a few choice words to say to him, which we won't repeat here, they all hugged and there was a celebration. There was something that felt right about it. The second series, which obviously drew in so many poor people, had become such a popular series, the finale ended very differently. There were 3 people left at the very end. 2 of them were faithfuls. 1 of them was a traitor. If the 2 faithfuls had banished the traitor, they would have taken the prize money home. But in that final moment, as Claudia Winkleman said, do you want to end the game? 1 of the faithful said, no, I think this guy is a traitor. And there was another girl left. They got to vote again. And this girl who had formed such a close friendship with the guy who was a traitor could not bring herself to vote for him. She said, no, I think you are the traitor. And so this other guy who was a faithful got banished, which meant at the end, because there was a traitor left, he took home the entire prize fund, £95,000, so much more than the winners of the first series got. This guy played the game brilliantly. He did what he was supposed to do. It's a game show. He went in, he was given the role of traitor. He played it brilliantly. Nobody apart from one person guessed he was a traitor. So he deserved the money. He played it brilliantly. But there was something not quite right about how it ended. Because in that moment where he stood facing this girl who'd become his friend and he said, "I'm a traitor," you literally saw her world fall apart. And we definitely won't play the clip in the church today because there were very, very choice words. She crumpled. The anger, the despair, how hurt she felt, how betrayed she felt was so evident as she stormed out of the room. And left in the finale was this one guy with £95,000, but without much of a sense of celebration. Because Claudia was there trying to kind of gym along, going, "How do you feel you've won all this money?" But watching it, it felt very different to a group of three people who won less money, but celebrated together. Because even though it was a game show, and even though this guy had played the game show brilliantly, there was still something not quite right about watching the betrayal of this girl who felt so let down by somebody that she trusted so much. Now, I don't know how you see Judas as we read this story. Maybe he is the ultimate traitor in the game show. The guy who had been with Jesus, who had ate with him, who had ministered with him, who had walked with him, and yet right at that last moment betrayed Jesus and let him down. Maybe the ultimate traitor. And as we read this story, I wonder if we had to put ourselves in this story, where you would put yourself. Maybe for some of us, we would put ourselves as the character of Peter, who, even though we didn't quite do the right thing, knew that we were standing up for Jesus and we got out our sword and we said, "No, you can't take him. I know this man is a son of God. I'm going to fight so he can survive." Maybe you would put yourself as one of the more passive disciples who stood and watched the events taking place but didn't say anything. But I wonder how many of us would put ourselves as the character of Judas, the person who betrayed Jesus, the person who let Jesus down. But can I suggest, actually, maybe every single one of us here this morning is the character of Judas? Because at the cross for each of us, we stand and look at Jesus as Judas did. It's the reason that the cross had to happen in the first place. Because it might be that when we read this story, we see Judas as the ultimate baddie, the person who betrayed Jesus, who let him down. But do you know what the reality was? Judas was just a guy who took his eyes off Jesus and put them on the world around him. We read in the book of John, chapter 13, that Judas had charge of the money. Elsewhere, it uses the phrase, he was the keeper of the purse. Judas was essentially the treasurer of the group. He looked after the money which they used to feed each other and to look after each other as they did their ministry. It was the days before internet banking. He didn't have it all online on a computer. It was the days before even safes existed. So if you were the holder of the purse, if you kept charge of the money, you physically had it on you. He would have had a belt with the money on him, I guess like an olden times bum bag. It was physically on him all of the time. He felt the weight of that money on him. And we read again in other accounts of these last few hours of Jesus' life that when Judas agrees to betray Jesus, he does it because he will get more money. That must have been hard for him. He spent his ministry with Jesus physically feeling the amount of money that they had. And so when someone else came along and said, "Hang on, I'll give you a little bit more money if you just betray this guy." Actually, for Judas in that moment, he took his eyes off Jesus and he said, "Okay, if I betray Jesus, I get all this money that I'm physically carrying, but I get a little bit more as well." And for each of us this morning, there are all things for all of us that come in between us and Jesus. Those moments where we take our eyes off Jesus because something over here just feels that a little bit more enticing, or it feels that a little bit easier, or we just feel a little bit swayed by the world around us or the things that we're reading or seeing. And so we take our eyes off Jesus. We can all be Judas. And that might feel like a really offensive thing to say, but actually it's true for each of us. But the wonderful, wonderful truth this morning, the incredible reason that we look towards what happened at Easter, not just Jesus dying on the cross, but Jesus resurrecting and rising and beating death once and for all, is because although we stand at the cross and we look at Jesus as Judas did, letting things of this world come in between us and Jesus, actually, it's because of the cross that we can stand and look at Judas as Jesus did. That's the incredible truth that we celebrate this morning.
So how was it that Jesus did look at Judas? What was it that made Jesus feel about Judas and still have him with him as one of his friends? We read these words a few kind of hours earlier when Jesus was sat having his final meal with his disciples. And these are the words that Jesus says in John chapter 13, verse 26 of Judas. "It is the one to whom I will give this piece of bread when I have dipped it in the dish." Then dipping the piece of bread, he gave it to Judas, Simon, son of Simon Iscariot. Craig Keener writes to help us kind of understand what this moment means. "For the host to dip a piece of bread in the common bowl and hand it to someone was a sign of honour to the person who received it." Here Jesus offers Judas one final expression of love. Even though Jesus knew what Judas was about to do, that he was about to betray him, he still offered him both honour and love. It's a simple moment that we might read in the Bible and not quite understand what's happening. Oh yeah, Jesus gave Judas this piece of bread to mark out that he was going to be the one who was going to betray him. But it was so much more than that. In this simple act of giving Judas a piece of bread, Jesus simply says to him, "I love you. What you're about to do does not change that. I love you. Take the bread." In the garden, Judas comes to execute his final act of betrayal with a detachment of soldiers. Now, I don't know how many soldiers you envision in the garden when you kind of think about this moment. I think I kind of always felt like a little group of 10 or 12. But as I was reading about it this week and kind of reading more about this passage, a detachment of soldiers could be up to 600 soldiers. There were a lot of people in that garden when they came to arrest Jesus. Judas at the front, to perform his ultimate act of betrayal. And when they say, "Who is Jesus?" Jesus responds twice with these words, "I am he." And the first time he says this, if you remember, as Mike read, it says they fell to the floor. That's a lot of people who fell over at once just because Jesus said, "I am he." But it's a phrase that Jesus has already used about himself. Three times in John chapter 8, people are arguing about who is Jesus? Who is this man? What is his being? Is he God? Is he not God? Is he a prophet? We don't understand. Who is this man? And three times Jesus answers, "I am he." The Greek translation, ego emeia, means "I am he." But he's also translated exactly the same as the Hebrew is in the Old Testament, where we read similar words, "I am." "I am" in the Old Testament is the way that Yahweh, God, refers to himself. It's the name of God. "I am." "I am he." They're both translated the same. So in responding, "Where is Jesus? Who is Jesus?" Jesus simply replies, "I am God. I'm not going to fight you. I'm not going to punish you. I simply am saying, I am God." Jesus responds to Judas with both truth and love. "I am God and I love you." As Jesus dies on the cross, he takes away every single moment where the world comes between us and Jesus. It all goes. All those things that Judas did where the world became more exciting, that's why Jesus died on the cross. Because he knew for each of us there would be so many things that would take our eyes off Jesus and put them on the world around us. And he says, "No, I love you too much. I'm going to die on the cross and I'm going to rise again, beating all of those things so that you can put your eyes back on me, knowing that you are loved, knowing that that broken relationship between us and God could be restored." He offered us a way to stand with him again in a beautiful fullness of relationship with God. We're forgiven, we're loved, and we're accepted, whoever we are. Whatever you've done, that's the truth that Jesus offers to you when you come into a relationship with him. Now, I don't know how many of you have had experiences of being forgiven. I'm sure all of us at some point in our lives have had to be forgiven for something we've done. I remember being a child and I wasn't allowed in my parents' bedroom. I definitely wasn't allowed into my mum's makeup cupboard, drawer, bag, whatever it was. But I also remember that as a child, I didn't always do what I was told. And I remember one particular day going into my mum and dad's bedroom, which I wasn't allowed to do, helping myself to my mum's makeup, literally smearing it over my face as I thought happened, coming back downstairs and saying, "Mummy, do you think I look beautiful?" My mum did not think I looked beautiful, because in that moment, she realised what I had done was what I was not supposed to do. I got told off and quite strongly had to remove the makeup from my face. That story was a story that was brought up quite a lot. So even though I was told off and I was forgiven, sometimes when we had family gatherings or sometimes when I was a little bit cheeky, that story would be brought back up again. Do you remember that time that you went and kind of just helped yourself to the makeup that you weren't allowed to? I was kind of forgiven. But in Hebrews chapter 8, a book later on in the New Testament, it says, "For I will remember their sins no more." We don't have to feel guilt or shame for any of the times where we have been like Judas in our lives. Because once we come into a relationship with Jesus, once we say sorry, it's not just forgiven, it has completely gone. It's not a story that Jesus will whisper, "I've forgiven you, but do you remember that time that you did that thing? It's gone. I will remember their sins no more." We are forgiven, we are loved, we are fully accepted. I remember saying things when I first became a Christian, like, I know that God's forgiven me, but I just can't forgive myself. That statement doesn't make sense. If God has forgiven you, there is nothing for you to forgive yourself anymore, because you are forgiven. You are not God. God has forgiven you, and it has gone. I will remember their sins no more. So what does it practically mean for us? That even though we can be Judas, actually we can, because of what Jesus has done, be like Jesus looking at Judas with love and with truth. All of those things that we've done, gone, forgotten, forgiven. Well, it gives us a freedom that goes against so much of the world might tell each one of us. Because the world might say to us, "Do you know what? Someone's let you down. Someone's betrayed you. Go on, get even." But with Jesus, we can do something different. The world might tell you, "Just cut that person out of your life. Have nothing more to do with them." But with Jesus, we can do something different. The world might tell you, "Take revenge on those people who have hurt you." Or get everyone else on side. Tell everyone else how awful that person is. Say horrible things about them behind their backs so that everyone believes you and everyone thinks you're the champion. But with Jesus, we can do something different. The world might say, "Just give up on that person. They are beyond anything that you can possibly do. Give up on them." But with Jesus, we can do something different. Because the forgiveness, love, and compassion that Jesus offers to each of us, we can extend to every single person around us. I don't know if you recognize the picture of the two ladies on the screen now. Back in summer 2005, Anthony Walker was murdered in a horrifically racially motivated attack. He was 18 years old at the time. This is his mum and his sister, G and Dominic Walker. The murder shocked the nation, and it was in the news for quite a long time. But I think what was even more shocking for many people was the reaction that his family had. Two women who had a firm belief in Jesus, who knew Jesus in their lives. And when they spoke about what had happened, when they were asked how they felt following Anthony's murder, these are some of the words that they said 2 years later. This is his mum speaking. "When you lose someone you love, it hurts so much. The pain is constant. It's like having a bag or a suitcase, and you're packing anger, you're packing resentment, bitterness, revenge, and the things that go with unforgiveness, and it's a heavy weight. But if I offload the anger, if I offload the bitterness, the revenge, all the things that go into planning the revenge, otherwise it is too much. Losing my Anthony is a big weight to carry, but taking on those other things is too much. So I choose that I do not wish to take them on." And then his sister in the same interview went on to say, "I lost my best friend, my little brother, and it was hard to understand what forgiveness was. But I'm telling you, 2 years on, I know what it is, and I practice it every day. It has to be an everyday thing." Powerful words from someone people who had gone through such a horrific incident in their life, but wanted to know that forgiveness extended to them meant they could live in a new sense of freedom. I remember something happening to me many years ago. It was wrong. It was unjust. It was unjust in the eyes of the law. It was a wrong thing that happened to me. For a long time, I really struggled to forgive the person who had done it. Because in my head, I equated forgiveness with excusing their behaviour or saying that it was just something that didn't matter. It made the actions okay. I found it really hard to forgive because of that. But what I learned was that forgiveness doesn't say what happened was okay. Forgiveness doesn't mean that I'm excusing the actions that have happened to me. But forgiveness enables me to live differently. Because I don't have to be defined or held back by the actions that someone else has done to me. I can get rid of those things. I can choose to lay them down. And I love what Dominic Walker, Anthony Walker's sister, said, that it's an everyday thing. Just as I choose to invest into my friendships, into the relationships of the people that I love, I spend time investing into them every day so that I maintain those friendships. Actually, in the same way, forgiveness is an everyday choice. I don't wake up every morning and go, oh, brilliant, I've totally forgiven that person. But I choose to wake up every morning and say, I will forgive that person. And it might be that in making that choice, in saying I'm going to lay down that backpack that carries the anger, the resentment, the revenge, there are things like counselling and pastoral support that will help you do that. But it is a choice to step into a new way of freedom, a new life that allows you to know the freedom, the love, the compassion that Jesus has for you because of what he did for you. And as we move into a time of communion now, we're going to be thinking about what it was that Jesus did when he died on the cross. That he stepped into the gap and said, I am here. That gap between you and the world, where so easily the world can distract you or take your eyes off me. I'm going to stand right in the middle of that, with my arms open wide, offering love and relationship to every single person to come into a relationship with me because I love you. Because I don't remember the things that you've done anymore. They have gone. They're not just forgotten, they are gone, completely gone. And it might be that in this moment, we're going to sing a song before we go into a time of communion, that you might be with some stuff you want to do with God right now. To actually say, I'm going to take this moment to bring before you, God, something or a situation that I do know I need to forgive others for. Knowing that it doesn't excuse the behaviour, it doesn't make it okay, but knowing that I want to live in the freedom of not being held back or defined by someone else's actions. That I want to know what it is to live in the freedom of love and compassion that Jesus extends to me. So it might be that you want to spend some time with God, making that an everyday choice. It might be that there are things that you know you just want to lay before God and say, I know that I've let the world get in the way. And I'm bringing those things before you now because I know that they're completely gone when I bring them before you. It might be that there are other people that you know that you need to go and say sorry to, knowing that your actions probably have caused them hurt. But knowing that in that moment where you say sorry, that for each of us, we can stand with our hands open and say, it's okay, thank you. It's a really tough thing, but the beautiful, beautiful part of it all is that every single person here today, every single person that you know, every single person who is watching us at home, every single person in this city, across this nation, across this world, has the opportunity to come into a relationship with a God who simply says, I love you. I am God and I love you. And I extend that message. I extend that invitation to come into relationship with me to every single one of you. Just take that step into it. Knowing there is nothing that you have done, there is nothing that you will do that will ever stop Jesus from loving you. Because once you say sorry, it's gone. You are loved, you are chosen, and you are forgiven.